Welcome to The World in Which You Occur. This is a work that began last fall in the context of a project called Pharmacokinetics of an Element, which was essentially a reading group, a site visit, together with a public lecture that dealt with issues inside of pragmatism and ecology, ecological issues. And this event emerged at the moment in collaboration with my co-hosts here today, Margarita Mendez. It's loosely inspired by James Lee Byers' 1969 work called World Question Center, which essentially consisted of Byers reaching out to a number of key individuals, thinkers, artists, scientists across the world, and asked them to propose a question that they found that preoccupied them in that particular moment. And there was an element, we can say, of urgency around those questions. Our format, The World in Which We Occur, is sort of lends itself to the legacy of different hybrids that have emerged out of Byers' work. And in this case, we intend to reach out to a number of speakers across the world via the telephone and embarking on issues that are around the history of materiality, flux, very pertinent scientific issues with great leaps of political urgency that are happening in the world today. So that's a bit of context for you. The way it works is that we reach out to each speaker. I'll be, together with Margarita, we'll be asking them to pose a question, and then we'll see what kind of unfolds from there. Margarita, you have to say a couple words on the archive.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I wanted to ask you to turn your phones off. I wanted to also say that this is like a listening session, so you are invited to relax. There won't be any participation, but your senses. And these sessions are going to be available on a voice archive that, if you visited the exhibition of the Triennial, is on top of the stairs on a phone that you can use as a consultation system, dialing the codes of each speaker. So by Monday or Tuesday, as soon as we do these 2 weekend sessions, there will be another one tomorrow at 6:30. They will be available for consultation, also online.
I think I'll jump straight into the session, which is today is called the Pharmacon. And essentially, that emerged out of, like I mentioned before, the pharmacokinetics of an element. And pharmacokinetics refers to the movement of a drug into, through, and out of the body, the time course of its absorption, bioavailability, distribution, metabolism, and excretion. It can be thought of the way that toxic materials move through the body and express their element, as well as an idea plane where theoretical constructions form and emerge. In the first session that took place in November of 2014, one speaker, Nabila Mehta, asked, how does poison produce an idea of a movement in the dead body? Can the idea of movement be assigned to this ambivalent moment that we're living in and experiencing today? And how can we heal the partition in the modern age and within our crisis with nature? In this session, we're going to take a little bit of a step back into the frame of the Pharmacon itself, and which addresses the larger questions of the body and the earth from the position of what the Pharmacon itself being a remedy and a poison. So this dualist relationship between remedy and poison. Our intention here is to expose this loop of definition that the Pharmacon proposes, whether it be from the perspective of nutrition and food, such as milk, contaminated waters or spirits, and bodily consumption. So right now we're going to reach out to Barbara Orland. We're going to go ahead and she's in Basel. I'll then introduce you to her. Barbara, hi.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Jennifer and Margarita here calling from CAC Vilnius in the CAC Cinema in the context of The World in Which We Occur. How are you?
Hi, fine.
Good.
Thank you.
I'm going to share your bio a little bit with our audience here, and then we can move forward with a question that you find pertinent, say, for your practice today or with urgency, and then we can move from there. So Barbara Orland is a senior lecturer of the history of the life sciences at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Before, she worked as a senior scientist at the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich and as the chair of history of technology and the Collegium Helveticum. Between 2004 and 2007, she was the managing director of the Center History of Knowledge at the Federal Institute of Technology and the University of Zurich. Her current research interests range from the history of the life sciences and biomedicine, for example, scientific concepts of fertilization and pregnancy, nutrition and metabolism, and biomaterials like blood and milk. So Barbara, can you pose a question for us today?
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the invitation and also for the introduction. It's a funny feeling to speak to an audience which I can't see. How many people are there, excuse me? That
I Maybe 40?
40, okay.
30?
Hello, each of you. Well, I only have one question that I want to introduce to you, and that is a very easy but nevertheless a very fundamental question. I want to ask you, what is a pharmacon? And I want to emphasize, let's think about the meaning of this word. Do we all have the same meaning? And has this meaning changed throughout history? From a today's perspective, or from our common perspective, I would argue that we moderns tend to think that a pharmacon is any kind of drug. It is a pharmaceutical product or a product of the pharmaceutical industry. Pharmacons are remedies or cures that help physicians to heal illnesses or ailments. And as such, we leave the work and the domain of definition to the pharmaceutical science and industry. And they tell us that drugs are biologically active substances. But what means biological activity? As Jennifer mentioned before, I'm a historian of science, medicine, and technology, and in so far my perspective is very different. It's probably much broader than a pharmaceutical one. I would call myself a historian of materiality, especially biomateriality. And what does that mean? In recent years, disciplines such as history, philosophy, literary criticism, or science and technology studies have taken an intense interest in things and their materiality. And this interest went along with debates on the relations between scientific and other ways of knowing about the world. And in the shape of these many criticized common distinctions, like the distinction between nature and culture and body and technology and material and mind, etc., etc. So with such an perspective, I would not ask what is a pharmacon, but I would change my question and broaden it into a question, what means medical materiality? The title of your event also suggests that we should broaden our perspective. That means with respect to the pharmacon, the pharmacy's way of thinking is not the sole point from which we can unpack people's relationships with the material world. We should not only ask what is a pharmacon in the narrow sense of a drug, but instead, what do we mean by healing power or curativeness? How do we find out that some substances are healing and others not? That some are even poisonous, that can harm our bodies? As you can imagine, these kinds of questions can only be answered if we take the relationship between body and pharmacon into account. We must shift from pharmacy, so to say, to physiology, to think about the body and the material that is incorporated. And also, I think such a perspective on the medical materiality asks for the practice of gaining knowledge or producing knowledge. And that includes some kind of second order reflections on the methods societies use to detect and use substances as medicaments. So to sum up, I would prefer not to speak of a pharmacon, but of medical materiality. Anyway, with such an extended perspective, I think such an extended perspective allows some discoveries. And as a historian, I like to start with a conceptual history of words. We inherited the term pharmakon from the old Greeks. Platon already used this word. However, it's irritating to see the multiple meanings he used, and some of them even sound contradictory to our ears. In Plato's dialogue, pharmakon could mean a remedy as well as a poison, or a drug as well as a recipe, a substance, but also a color. In Plato's dialogues, pharmakos referred even to sacrifice rituals. He discusses societal and medically intended catharsis rituals. So pharmakon in Plato's sense is a very ambiguous term, even unclear, and for sure not compatible with our modern definitions of materiality. We have learned from chemistry and physics. Our knowledge is mainly a physical-chemical knowledge that conceptualizes the material world on the basis of the smallest timeless units, and our world is a modular system of eternal static elements. Although we all know that in our daily life, the material world is much more sensitive and even much more chaotic than chemistry and physics tell us. We live in a constantly changing world of appearances, which produces in endless sequences a flow of fleeting sensory perceptions. Thus, in other words, there exists a difference between the scientific bottom-up molecular perspective on materials, including pharmacon, and our daily life experiences. The material world in which we live does not reveal pure chemical elements. We breathe air and not oxygen. And this is reflected. This is not, the physical, chemical definitions are not reflected in our daily sensory experiences. We can only experience material mixtures and transitional forms, materials that are somehow an activity, they are moving, they are in movement, and so on. Now let's go back to history and then take a view from history that confirms that the molecular perspective on the world is a very, very young perspective. Not before the end of the 18th century and the rise and success of structural chemistry, people got used to think that way. Before, and even for centuries, especially medicine and physiology, including pharmacy, examined the nature or explored the nature as an economy of fluids. People, including scholars or scientists, experienced the body not as a molecular body as we do today, but as a humoral body. The early modern body was not a stable entity. It was fluid. It was porous. It was a volatile humoral body. And bodily fluids such as blood, milk, semen, sweat, tears, etc., were constantly changing. That was practically impossible for a physician to define what is normally good blood, because it changed every moment in every body. Physicians thought in terms of a liquid physiology, even when they were studying the skeleton, the muscles, or the organs. This is a complete different epistemology, what I want to emphasize here. So they were not only talking about a substance as a poison, or milk, for example, as a food, but they were thinking in terms, to say it in modern way, of metabolic substances, bad and good humors at the same time. Depending on the character, the living conditions, food, air, weather, and many other environmental influences, the humors could change from one moment to the other, from a good into a bad, pathogenic, or even toxic substance. To give you an example, which I know best, Jennifer mentioned it, I studied the history of milk. To take this example, if a woman was nursing, so giving milk, and her lactation was blocked or even unbalanced, somehow unbalanced, then nature would respond with numerous illnesses, postpartum fevers and tumors, headaches, and even mental disorders like melancholy could be the consequence. And it is paradox to read that the same physician could at first argue that it was the milk of the wet nurse that has affected a child, made it ill, and at the same moment prescribed a milk diet as a cure to this concrete baby. And also, it is from our modern perspective very irritating to read that milk, since the antique times, was a pharmacon, a materia medica. Pharmacopoeia of the 16th and 17th century recommended milk recipes in many different forms of mixtures and powder, plaster, compresses, beverages, drops, and pills, and clysters, and baths, and they prescribed it externally and internally, and most often they prescribed it as a dietetic remedy for the refreshment and the strengthening of the sick and so on, and even for as a preventive measure for longevity. And they also had a clear impression of the quality of milk. Women's milk was regarded the best, followed by asses and goats' milk, and the medically worst milk was cow's milk. The reason why women's milk was regarded the best was that this was human milk, and for that reason it was most similar to the body that should eat it or drink it. Beside medical reasons, fluid milk was only the necessary food for babies. It was drunk by pregnant women and nursing mothers, but it was only for medical reasons drunk by adults. And moreover, it was no masculine drink. Men refused to drink milk until the 19th century, and it was a hard work on the milk industry to make men to milk drinkers. So, to come to an end, the question, what is a pharmacon, is probably not so easy to answer as thought in the very first moment. What I want to say is the answer depends on our knowledge perspective, and that is culturally and historically different. And what I also want to emphasize is that we should start thinking about materiality beyond our scientific definitions, or the scientific definitions we are used to. To think about materiality is sometimes, certainly it's sometimes confusing and provocative, but in any case it is surprising. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara. It's great to hear your question and the explication, and thank you for being with us today.
We'll get back to you later in the week and show you the recordings. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
So now we're going to reach to Carolina Caicedo, who's actually in Colombia at the moment, in some mountains, doing field work.
Yes.
So.
Carolina Caicedo is a Colombian artist living in between Los Angeles and Berlin, and whose practice moves beyond the bounds of the studio, gallery, and institution, extending into the realm of the social, where she explores systems of movement and exchange, as well as processes of assimilation and resistance. She engages with issues and contexts that affect the broad public on an everyday level, and in her work, art functions as a tool for offering alternative models to inhabit a world in which individuals and communities are increasingly subject to commodification, exploitation, and discrimination. So, Carolina, did you find a quiet spot to deliver your question?
Or yeah, I'm ready. Questions?
Good. Go ahead.
So, first, instead of delivering a question, I'm going to ask you for something to the public. Hopefully everyone can engage. So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. So please close your eyes and place your hands over your eyes. And take a deep breath. Try to listen to your breath. And if possible, try to listen to the breath of your neighbor. And I'm going to ask you to put your fingers over your nostrils and take a deep breath through the mouth. And exhale. And now put your hand over your mouth, take a deep breath through your nostrils. And hopefully you still have your eyes closed. And now put your hands over your ears and breathe and listen to your breathing, to your internal breathing. And thanks so much for engaging and for the little exercise to bring the body present. We're going to talk about the body. It's always a good idea to feel our own body and hopefully the bodies of the persons around us. One of the first questions I want to pose is, what is territory? And I've learned that the first and foremost territory is my own body. This is the first territory, and it's a territory that has been colonized as a Latino mestiza. There's many layers of colonization in my body, in my territory. And through work that I've been doing in the past years, I've been trying to decolonize and like strip off those layers, and also through those stripping of colonial layers, hopefully connecting with the surrounding territory, or with what some people call landscape. But I believe landscape is it's a concept that doesn't resonate with me very much because it sees nature as an object for contemplation, something that is outside the body or perhaps disconnected. And so if the first and foremost territory is my own body, I'm trying to look or think about, or the next question would be, or is just like, what are the mechanisms of reappropriation of that body, of decolonization? And if that process entails of reappropriation of also physical territories like rivers and forests and other ecosystems where I inhabit. And so thinking also about biopolitics, but also necropolitics. And I question myself if colonization of my body is also a form of necropolitic or a form of killing me, a form that that an imposition of a system has found to kill me or to kill my body. And I find that yes, it's sometimes control comes not as the way that they ask you or impose you to live your life, but in the way that they or a system slowly kills you or deteriorates the body. So there is a process of mortality through deterioration, and I've seen it in basically two indigenous groups. One is the Yaqui people in the desert of Sonora in northern Mexico, and the other is the people of the Wayuu people who inhabit in northern Colombia and northern Venezuela. They're both very interesting indigenous groups. Both have resisted also several layers of colonization, religious, political, and social colonization, also processes of displacement. And however, they remain very numerous compared to other indigenous groups in the Americas, a numerous group, and also a group that have held hard and strong to their language, to their cosmovision, and to their land. Both groups exist between borders. So the Yaqui people exist between Sonora and Arizona, and the Wayuu exist in the bioregion called La Guajira that exists between Colombia and Venezuela. And at the moment, they are experiencing a process of mortality through deterioration or an ethnocide, because the water they drink is poisoned by tailings of open pit mines. In the case of the Yaqui, a copper open pit copper mine called La Caridad, and in the case of the Wayuu, it's an open pit coal mine. So, what is this kind of violence? It's a slow violence. It's an environmental and it's an intentional violence. It's a violence that traverses territory. So in this case, from the territory of water and landscape into the body, to the body. And it's tailing from privatized endeavors, private capital, who is like opening the earth and extracting material. And in this process, generating tailings toxicity and immersing whole cultures like in a toxic environment. And deterioration also kind of gives way to fragmentation. And so I think also about questions of fragmentation, precisely in Colombia, that the images of fragmentation are so alive after enduring civil conflict for over 50 years. But in the last 20, the visuals of fragmentation really pierced our everyday, and the chainsaw was used as a tool for that fragmentation, for the fragmentation of the enemy, of the bodies of the enemy. And it was a very efficient tool for dismembering not only a body, but the connections that a loved one could have to that body. Because when you connect to a body or to a person, you connect to that whole. But once you have a fragmented body, it's very difficult to connect to an arm or to a hand or a head. And so my next question will be if the fragmentation and deterioration go hand in hand in the kind of necropolitics over the body, and how could these also reflect over the politics over nature, over a politics of nature, or a politics, ecology politics that emanate from neoliberal or capital systems that envision a river, for example, as a resource. We are facing this this kind of system and view right now in Colombia. We have a river, it's called the Yuma, the colonized name is Magdalena. And we're facing the privatization of this body of water. They want to build 17 dams along this river. And so the chainsaw as a tool for dismembering, as a tool from the necropolitics that emanates from the state, the Colombian state, that apparently had been put under the, in a drawer, because now we're like in peace conversations, have resurfaced again. The chainsaw as a tool for dismembering a body. And right now we're facing the filling up of the second of this chain of 17 dams. And before a dam starts to get filled with the water, all the organic material has to be removed from the territory. And so the chainsaw has appeared again as a main tool to cut down the bodies of trees, the bodies of forests, or the forest as a body of an ecosystem. And so, again, the visuals and the sounds of the chainsaw have come back to haunt and to connect us to a past also. So it is a question of also of time, of what I was saying before, full violence that is perpetrated over a number of decades over the same population. So if we were speaking about the body as the first and foremost territory, as the bolt that connects us to other living bodies, call it a river or a forest. What happens when this body, this first territory, is displaced? I think that one of the consequences of this displacement is that we get used to look at landscapes or at maps or at territories that are void of humans also. And I'm thinking about the visuals of satellites and the visuals of our everyday, what we look in our phones to get anywhere, like a Google map or whatever tool we use in our phones. And it shows us a direction, a street, a river, or a road in the countryside. But it never shows us nothing that inhabits this location. And we'd kind of be entrained, I understand this, the training of our eyes to understand a land or an earth or a planet void of people or other entities. a training also to over understanding that nature is a resource, like a resource outside us, that has to be developed and aprovechado or extracted. So I guess one of the questions also, and that is haunting me really strong right now, after working 3 years around this dam and working close with the communities in resisting this dam, and anyhow it got constructed and it's being filled up at the moment, this question is like, what do we harvest after 3 years of work in the communities and with the communities and in the territory, and still this mega project of extraction is being completed? I don't have an answer, but it's a question I have. What do you harvest after working with the community for so many years, and what you were struggling for is still taking place, or what you were struggling against, I would say. And I think this has to do also with not only territorial struggles, but also ontological struggles, and also this exercise of stripping layers of colonization from my body, and also that teaching, or that, you know, the teaching I grew up with, had they taught me how to be or how to become in relation with other beings. And I don't know if this answers the last question, but definitely what I find, or something I can take away after these years of working with communities, is that there is a struggle for the territory and for the right, and the right of clean water, not contaminated water, the right of dying however nature provides. Death provides us with death, and not an imposed death through poisoning or deterioration or dismembering. But there's also a struggle of how we become, or how we relate to the world, how we constitute a subject. And I guess I've also understand that how other entities sees us or sees me is valid, no? And that my ontology is co-constituted between subjects. And I want to bring up also a quote of Eduardo Viveros de Castro in his book, in his essay, Exchange in Perspective, where he speaks about Amazonian cosmovision, where he says, I'm going to open the quote, it says, animals are ex-humans rather than humans ex-animals. In some cases, humankind is the substance of the primordial plenum, or the original form of virtually everything, not just animals. And so the sharing of our human essence is with a type of non-human beings is what ties these territories together. And also is what kind of keeps on, this understanding is what keeps pushing me to return to working with the community, or to keep on, even though that we didn't manage to stop this dam. I've been also looking information about what happens when the struggle you've been engaged with is not successful, or maybe not successful, but doesn't have the outcome you were expecting. And so there is some physical consequences, like that of deterioration through poisoning, or dismembering also. But also the question is, what happens with how do you feel, or what happens inside that territory? What happens inside the body? And I found a term that I wasn't familiar with called eco-depression. And right now I'm in a town called Pital in the middle of Colombia, very near where the filling of the dam is. And it seems like the whole town is under eco-depression. Very low and very void of energy, kind of with a high sensation of frustration and impotence, just seeing how the water is rising. And so it seems like the control of water or the privatization of a body of water not only has effects on the body or on the physical connections, the visible connections or the visible bodies, but also the invisible feeling and the invisible connection between those bodies. And it also, the control of water, the poisoning of water, the damming of a body of water, also affects memory, the memory of our muscles. And I see also how people have changed their gestures towards the river. So for example, I'm thinking about, for example, a friend that's a fisherwoman that used to go every day to fish. Fish have disappeared from the river. That gesture, that everyday choreography of going to the river and casting the net have become part of a recent past. And I think about her four children whom she taught how to fish. And she taught how to fish in a very particular way, holding the net with her mouth and then casting it with her left hand while she was holding the line with the right hand. And how all her four kids have learned this gesture from her mother. And it's a gesture that they won't teach to their own kids. So makes me think also how the privatization of bodies of water also has direct effects on the transmission of knowledge, of accumulated knowledge, and of a knowledge that is transmitted through the movement of a certain muscle or a certain gesture. So this connection is cut through the dam. So the dam, the wall of a dam, or the tailings of an open pit mine become instruments, again, I bring up the word of deterioration and fragmentation, of direct streams of knowledge and direct connections with of social bodies and bodies of water. I'm not sure how much time I have, but can you just give
thank
me
you.
A...
Thank you, Carolina. I think of... there was quite a full contribution. We have a lot to think through.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Carolina.
Okay.
It was Jennifer, great to hear. Yes?
Can I end then with a string of questions? And
go
then
for, go
yes,
for it.
Of course. Yeah. So I'm going to say goodbye, and then by saying goodbye, I'm just going to ask a string of questions that perhaps I'm in the process of finding an answer, but the questions related to dams. And so the first question is, well, with both in contemporary dam planning and social repression strategies, what remains underwater? What remains submerged or invisible? The other question is, if the police is the face or the facade and the frontality of established power, are they the walls or like dams that protect the structure of or a system? Another question is, what is the role of scale in police repression and in dam construction or huge open pit mining? And if social promise and development are distraction techniques of mega infrastructures today, is security be a distractor in military and police social regimes? Is corporate construction of dams in Latin America a continuation of the colony? Is a dam a siege of nature? Is security a siege of community? I guess I can finish with that.
Thank you so much, Carolina.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Carolina Caicedo from Colombia, and now we're going to reach out to Pedro Neves Marquez. His number is Margarita.
Is that you?
Hey, hi, Margarita.
Hi. We're calling you from the CAC auditorium. We have an audience of 50 people, more or less. I'm here with Jennifer. Hello.
Hi, how are you, Jennifer?
Good, how are you?
Thanks. I hope everything's going well.
Yes, you are our last speaker for today. We have already spoke with Barbara Orland in Basel and Carolina Quecedo in Colombia.
Wow.
So I'm going to start by introducing you and then give you the ground.
Thank you.
So Pedro Neves Marx is a visual artist and writer. He is the editor of the anthology on Antropofagia, Anthropology and Indigenous Cosmologies in Brazil, The Forest and the School, Where to Sit at the Dinner Table, published with Archive Books and Académie des Kunst der Welt in 2015. Pedro is the author of the short story collection The Integration Process, and recently he was a guest editor of the IFLUX issue Super Community for the Biennale di Venezia. Shifting between the theoretical and fictional, his work and writing has focused on technologies of embodiment and crossings between distinct ontologies, including comparisons ranging between ecology, economics, and anthropology, with a particular interest in non-modern systems of knowledge in South America. This has included the cosmopolitical role of interspecies predation and cannibalism in Amerindian societies, geophagy, and the diffuse border between pollution, the body, and the earth, perspectivist and multinaturalist theories, as well as the historical ramifications between economics, cybernetics, and our current environmental catastrophe. Pedro, do you have some questions for us?
Yeah, thanks. I guess I prepared some thoughts to share and some questions, which I will be mostly reading, actually. I guess, can I start?
Go ahead.
Yeah? Okay, thanks. To start, I would like to go back to Deleuze and Guattari's Anti-Oedipus and talk about think about the inscription and the possibility of a total indistinction between body and the earth, the body of the animal, the human or otherwise, and the body of the earth. And so my first questions, I think, are, can the body and the earth be separated, or more exactly, when and how were they separated? At the origins of naturalist modernity, beginning sometime around the 16th century, just as medieval organicist philosophies began to be supplanted by a mechanicist, reductionist view of nature along the lines of the separation between the body and the soul. Can you hear me well?
Can you hear well?
Can you hear me well?
It's raining now.
Okay?
So, yeah.
Okay. So I'll keep going. If there's anything, just stop me.
Okay.
So for this set of questions relating to this idea of the body and the earth is what is it to inscribe, to mark, to carve, to perforate and punctuate, basically to draw in nature, but also to let oneself be marked from the outside, from nature. What is it to ingest? Is there a difference between marking the body, the human body, and marking the body of the earth? So going to Deleuze and Guattari in Anti-Oedipus, one can read about the difference between oral societies and writing societies, about times and societies where graphism is independent from the voice as two different systems of inscribing desire, alliance, and filiation in society. In other words, of creating kinship relations and producing society. This goes back to a discussion between Claude Lévi-Strauss and Edmund Leach about the Kachin of Burma and the ritual inscription of drawing in the body of women. So this is a quote. The articulation of the two elements, voice and graphism, takes place on the body itself and constitutes the sign, which is not a resemblance or imitation nor an effect of a signifier, but rather a position and the production of desire. So this idea of position is really important to what I want to share with you. And then I have a couple of two other quotes that I would like to share. One is from Michel Cartry, the Africanist anthropologist. quote, "The young woman must become physically saturated with the science of procreation, and she must incorporate them. The young women are never taught the meaning of the ideograms which are inscribed in their bodies during their initiation. The sign acts through its inscription in the body. The inscription of a mark on the body does not merely possess a message value here, but is an instrument of action that acts on the body itself." And then, "And what is this pain if not a pleasure for the eye that regards it, the collective or divine eye, that is not motivated by any idea of revenge, but is alone capable of grasping the subtle relationship between the sign engraved in the body and the voice issuing from a face, between the mark and the mask." And just, I promise, one last quote. This is from Pierre Clastre on the now basically extinct Guayaquil in Paraguay. Quote, "To choose the stone that will make a man of the young Guayaquil with enough pain and suffering by cleaving the length of his back, it must have a good cutting edge," says Clastre, "but not like a sliver of bamboo, which cuts too easily. Choosing the right stone, therefore, requires a practiced eye. The whole apparatus of this new ceremony is reduced to that, a rock, furrowed skin, scarified earth, one and the same mark." So I'm not really interested in if Deleuze and Guattari got this relation of inscription in the body anthropologically, if it's anthropologically correct, but I think they use some interesting words like body, inscription, relation, position, perspective, society, and then these other words like mask, eye, stone. So with this in mind, I would like to kind of to go back to a more a less theoretical and more ethnographic example, which kind of demonstrates what I'm trying to talk about. So in his fieldwork on the Ashuar of the Ecuadorian regions, anthropologist Philippe Descola tries to understand horticultural practices from the Ashuar point of view, particularly the cannibalistic qualities of their manioc gardens. So I imagine everyone knows manioc is a tuberous root that you can eat. At a certain point, Descola poses the following questions. Quote, "Against all odds, why do they, the Ashuar women, conceive the vegetable garden as a dangerous place threatened by vampirism? Why is gardening understood under the triangle of consanguinity? Why is the adequate manipulation of the cultivated plants conditioned by an unequal access to certain types of magical knowledge?" End quote. So Descola is mostly thinking about gender symmetry and the distribution of labor among the Ashuar, but in examining their vegetable gardens, it's really interesting to see how he manages to sketch the vegetable garden as a place of exchange between points of view, between humans and non-humans, or within an animist ontology between humans solely. So just to explain the situation, Ashuar women care to the manioc plants as their mothers, but at the same time protect their human children from the cannibalistic drive of the manioc plant. They say that the touch of the manioc leaf is sharp and cutting, and that with each cut, the manioc is in fact sucking blood from the children, and you often find cases of anemia in these communities. At the same time, manioc is a main food supplement in the Ashuar diet, and so within this wider social cosmos of their vegetable gardens, you have to see it's both a blessing and a threat. Manioc is food for the children to grow on, but also that which may kill the children. So you can say this is a perfect cannibal cycle, at the same time animal, vegetable, and human, including processes of consumption and production. So in a way, this is somewhat similar to other consumption production protocols found in South America in the Amerindian world, such as the relation between the raw and the cooked explored by Levi-Strauss. where certain substances must be devitalized or perhaps even dehumanized by cooking in order to break the cannibal cycle of kinship. In the Achuar vegetable gardens, maybe it's a bit different. There doesn't seem to be any moment equivalent to cooking, to dehumanization. So the garden becomes a place where multiple positions in the wide and layered animist cosmos make themselves visible, a place of multiplicity and society, a wider society. And so to close this example, one can ask, aren't then the vegetable gardens a place of cultured nature? On the one hand, yes, the women must care for the plants as they care to the children, because it is both because the manioc is both so vital and yet so dangerous. The vegetable gardens institute, so to say, culture within nature. But this is not exactly the taming of nature. It's in this case, there's a cultural learning in the vegetable garden, which is mutual and cosmic, a door to otherness and cosmological dialogue, learning from the other's point of view rather than simply the exercise of devitalizing the plant and controlling or disciplining the children. So what the women do is to sing particular incantations to the plants, similar to incantations that hunters sing to their prey, to not only to say who they are to the animal, but what kind of being is that animal before hunting it. So depending on how much time I still have, I would like to just change the subject in a way and talk about an inscription in the earth and not in the human body. So beginning in the late 1970s and more recently, many geoglyphs have been found throughout Western Amazonia in the state of Pará, but mostly on the border between Brazil and Bolivia. And geoglyphs are monumental inscriptions or constructions in the earth, which you can only see from the sky. These are mainly simple constructions, squares and circles, and roots linking these constructions. But all of them are being dated to the pre-Columbian era. They are only resurfacing now because of massive deforestation. And according to archaeologists, these constructions testify against the perceived idea that the pre-Columbian Indian population of lowland Amazonia were non-monumental and non-urban civilizations. This is not to say that they were in any way similar to the monumental cultures of the Andes, but more interestingly, that they cultivated a different type of urbanism, which has been called cluster urbanism. I don't know if you're going to have Paulo Tavares talking in a couple of days, but you can ask him in more detail about this. I also, alongside this idea of the geoglyph, I also want to add another recent discovery of South America, Terra Preta, which is in English Amazonian black earth or soil. And Terra Preta is an anthropogenic type of terraformation, a highly fertile and carbon sequestering soil mixture of charcoal, potsherds, manure, bones, and other elements, and was mostly used by Amazonians in agriculture. So while the geoglyphs may point to a different kind of urban inscription in the environment, a cluster civilization, closer to the garden cities perhaps, Terra Preta points to other sustainable modes of agriculture and recycling, perhaps similar to permaculture. So in a way, Terra Preta and the geoglyphs perhaps point to other modes of human inscription and communication with the body earth. And I have a couple of things that I could add on top of this, but I don't know if I'm already kind of going too long. So
you have time. You can
both. I'm fine? Okay, perfect. Yeah. So another topic I've been working on is that well, there's been a recent dating of the Anthropocene, which traces it back to the colonial genocide of the American conquest. So this new idea states that the conquest was so genocidal to have marked geological layers and possibly have changed atmospheric cycles in the 16th century. In a way, this was the biggest genocide within members of the same species ever registered, and is only comparable to what's happening nowadays, I guess, with the extinction of animal and plant life we are currently undergoing. In any case, this genocidal conquest completely destroyed the culture of Terra Preta, which is only now being rediscovered by climate change activists in laboratories, laboratories which many of them are fast and quickly beginning to patent the technology that somehow Terra Preta is, to sell it and within a patent. This patent, this product is called biochar, and it's a new market that's emerging with the knowledge that was extinct until very recently. With this in mind, and despite the geographical speculation, which will have to be examined, perhaps one can imagine that the plant regrowth caused by that genocide and the subsequent mass migrations and tribal wars that have covered the geoglyphs and literally erased them from modern history, burying them underneath the forest. In this way, the genocide will have surprisingly contributed to many ingrained anthropological primitivist beliefs about the people of the lowlands. Again, this idea of non-monumental and non-urban societies. I will close with this idea, with this image of the genocide and the erasure of these other traditional forms of inscribing the land and creating a social relation between different modes of being.
Thank you very much, Pedro. It was really good to hear your reflections and questions here.
Thank you.
We are closing the series tonight, and tomorrow we'll be back. Thank you very much, and take care. Bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Have fun. Okay, bye. Thank you.